So today we have an exciting episode with our dear friend, Michael Weiss.
Michael Weiss, entrepreneur and founder of Mushroom Life, is a self-taught mycologist and fungal enthusiast in the mid-Atlantic. A mushroom spagyric alchemist, cordyceps geneticist, and commercial mushroom forager, his life's work involves being a teacher, a guide, wild food purveyor, product developer, consultant, mushroom cultivator, photographer, permaculturist, ecologist, environmental steward, conservationist, and a friend to nearly all he meets. So tell us, Michael, how did you get into the wonderful world of mushrooms?
Oh, man. Well, it's a long and convoluted story, as many are. But I would say it started pretty early because I've always been fascinated with like biology and chemistry and all things nature, pretty much. You know, I barely knew anything about them at all in the mid-90s when I started growing them, pretty much. And they showed me an amazing realm that was very vast and bottomless, really. So anything that challenging and detailed, I kind of really take a liking to and just dig into. I ran into a lot of free time in like 2011-ish after a separation from my marriage and a couple of injuries climbing. Couldn't climb anymore. I wasn't doing as much massage therapy at the time, so I just kind of dove into the woods. And within a few months, my phone was just completely full of thousands of pictures of these entities. And the rest was history, you know? I knew it was kind of my moral obligation to start studying them and, I don't know, I guess show the other people, show the masses what all was out there, just the beauty that was out there for conservation purposes at first, but then it just all kind of unfurled as I went.
That's awesome. And you work with mushroom medicine and particularly with spagyric, so mushroom alchemy,
totally.
And also with herbs as well. And we had Robert Rogers on our show talking about mushroom essences. This is a little bit different. So for most of our listeners who probably have never, ever heard of spagyrics before, can you explain what they are in layman's terms and educate our listeners on what spagyrics are?
Yeah, so I can try. A spagyric is a name that's given to an alchemically prepared herbal extract. I guess it doesn't have to be herbal. It can be mycological or mineral or even metal, you know. Spal means to tear apart and agiro means to collect. So it's a conjunction of those two words coined by the Swiss scientist Paracelsus. With spagyrics, any item in nature is isolated and purified into one or more of its principles for its specific physical and or energetic attributes, really. The principles are the salt, the sulfur, and the mercury. The salt being the pure mineral fraction, the sulfur being the oils and waxes and nonpolar fraction, and the mercury being the volatile essences, or the alcohol of the associated kingdom.
Yeah, it's very intricate. How did you get into spagyrics?
Totally. So I got my first chemistry set when I was like 7 years old. I've always kind of been fascinated with that. Transmutations and such not, making potions and the sort. Chemists to me seem like sorcerers kind of back then. Magic was really appealing. I was always curious about the occult and really like obscure things and uncommon knowledge. So it kind of like fit right into there. I would say as early as like 13 years old, I would take my bike and go to the library and just dig into all these like witchcraft and black magic and alchemy and occult books and stuff like that. So I was really exposed to those concepts early. And it really appealed to me for like the practical alchemy side, you know, the external gold. I didn't really so much understand what was going on with the mystical or the internal gold yet, but that kind of fell in line later.
I can just picture, you know, 8-year-old you in the Library of Alexandria in Egypt, just, yeah, you know, flipping through all these books. This, that's awesome. And, you know, for people who, you know, don't know what a salt is or sulfur, you know, can you give us a basic run through of how you would make a spagyric?
Yeah. So, first of all, the timing is always determined by the stars. When I say that, I mean, like, the days of the week have a corresponding planet that rules them, you know, corresponding star. Not only that, but the hours of the day also have a corresponding planet. So if we're going to work with, say, reishi, which is our Mercury mushroom, because it has a lot of mercurial properties, it's always done on the day of Mercury. It's begun on the hour of Mercury, and it's finished on the hour of Mercury to keep it aligned astrologically. There are many ways to make spagyrics, and not all of them focus on all three principles. Some want the oils, and others want the resins. Some only want the essences, like you were talking about with Robert Rogers stuff. We use all three in ours. But we actually go a little bit further than that, because if we use traditional plant alchemy to make all three of our principles, it would not have the immunomodulating beta-glucans in there. So we also do the dual extract base and add the spagyric to that. So we have the best of both worlds.
Is it imperative to use a salicylate extractor when you're making spagyrics? And why do you use them? Or why do you like them?
The salicylate is not necessary at all. I feel like I use them because I like that it gives you a constant circulation of fresh solvent across the mark. You want to try and get as close to a 1-to-2 or 1-to-3 ratio as possible. So sometimes you're going to have to change out a salicylate a couple of times to get that same ratio that you would on a pour-over method. However, you get a better saturation because the solvent that comes in contact with your mark is fresh and hungry every time. It's completely renewed and cleaned of all of its solvent or all of its constituents that it's extracting.
Yeah, and for any of our viewers who don't know what a salicylate extractor is, please Google it.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
It's sexy. It's a sexy piece of glassware. And
totally.
I really want one. And we just went on a whole rabbit hole on cannabis extraction. And there are just like so many different methods, so many ways that were blowing my mind, which can be a whole nother podcast or a series. You know,
you could sit around for a few years just like reading about techs and different machinery without even lifting a finger to do any of the operations. You know, it's completely overwhelming, really.
Right. And you know, I feel like alchemy is a whole other universe that studied for lifetimes and lifetimes and you know, still wouldn't get even a grain of salt of understanding. And I see you sell them in your shop and you have days of the week on them. And your shop is mushroomlife.com and life is spelled LYFE.
So it's only LYFE on Instagram. It's actually just mushroomlife.com, spelled with an I.
There you go. Yeah, making it easy. And so are these days of the week what you recommend the day that people take this spagyric?
So not at all, but I'm glad you asked that because this is a really complex question. It's more symbology, really. With alchemy, a lot of things are aligned to the 7 classical planets. There's infinite symbology here. These classical planets were the non-fixed astronomical objects visible to the naked eye. So they were the only things that we could see with our naked eye that moved around in the sky. We attributed a lot of energies and concepts to those classical planets. So it kind of gives you like facets of meditation to contemplate as you ingest these things. You can ingest them on the day corresponding to, or the hour corresponding to, and there's even minutes corresponding to if you want to get into that. But for me, it's more contemplating that set of energies in my life and how those things relate to me and those things relate to that instant. The symbols themselves came from Byzantine codices, and they were supposed to represent the sun being male, the moon being female, and the five planets representing the five elements, essentially.
That's awesome. And, you know, yeah. I highly recommend everyone go to mushroomlife.com and check out these spagyrics and way more that you have to offer on your website. And, you know, you have a coupon code, REVIVAL, all lowercase, for 10% off. So if you're listening to this and you are like, oh my God, I got to get spagyrics, go to his website, use the coupon code, and fill up your goodie bag.
Yeah.
Check it out.
I had the pleasure of trying a spagyric that you gifted Alex, both Amanita and Cordyceps. And they're
awesome.
Potent.
What'd you think?
Oh my gosh, yeah. I really felt the Amanita one.
Totally. Taste alone like deepens your relationship with that ingredient, you know? It's like, you know, that facet alone in correlation with considering all of the other like meditations with each one, it's like, it's a really multifaceted experience.
Yeah. I'm excited to consume more. So for anyone who wants to know more about spagyrics, what resources do you recommend for them?
Oh man, there's like infinite stuff you could read. The things that come to my mind right off the top of my head would be alchemylab.com, the Alchemy Study Forum on Facebook, Robert Bartlett's book, Real Alchemy, any of Dennis William Houck's videos and stuff on YouTube. That's Houck, H-A-U-C-K. Google any of the alchemical terms, and that will take you down a rabbit hole for each one of them. And I mean, anytime you hear another word on that description, write it down and then Google that and follow that rabbit hole down. And then on each one of these texts and definitions, any name or any book name that you hear, write that down and follow that down the rabbit hole. That's how I follow, like, that's how I further my knowledge in this, because nobody's really showing me which direction to go with it. I just have to grab onto any piece visible and, you know, follow it.
Yeah. And it's so, you know, limitless and is such an in-depth field, which has been practiced for thousands of years, and it has such rich history and culture. And there's so much to learn about it. And I'm just curious, with your experience with spagyrics, what do you think is the future of spagyrics?
I think the future of spagyrics is probably a lot like the past. Advancements and realizations being individuals hard at work under long hours of thought, really. I think it's made up of a billion separate paths to knowledge of a higher way of being and relating to each other and in turn ourselves.
Beautiful. So you have a commercial foraging business, and I was hoping you could talk a bit about what that means, what you guys do, and if you mostly forage for the mushrooms that you use in your spagyrics.
So yes, we definitely forage for 99% of the stuff that we use in our spagyrics, with cordyceps being the exception to that, because there isn't really enough biomass out there for us to use wild. So we get wild strains to the lab, develop amazing cultures for people like you guys to grow lab-grown cordyceps for us to use to extract. As far as all the other stuff we get up to, though, it's kind of different every day. You know, it just depends on where we wake up, because we're always going to different spots, and we've been living somewhere different every 6 months or so for the past couple of years. You know, there's many factors involved with the logistics to consider. How long will the harvest take? How far away is the patch? What needs to be done once it's gathered to process it and store it correctly? Where do we have to go to deliver it? Is there a buyer for it all? You know, if we pick it all because we don't want to waste it, am I picking it to store, or am I picking it logistics involved in the day and deciding the course of it?
That sounds like a fun time.
So do you GPS track all your mushroom spots, and do you go back to the same spots year after year?
So, yes, sometimes, but not all of them. If it's a small patch or like item that I have to know exactly where it's at, then I'll definitely drop a pin and I'll store that location. And as the locations like build up to an alarming number of them, I'll actually write them down so they never get lost. But yeah, we go back to the same spots every year, but nature's not always doing the same thing on, you know, July 10th every year. So timing is everything with it.
Yeah, if you just want to send me those GPS coordinates, that'd be awesome.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I'll just take a picture of the entire list and send it right
yeah,
away.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks.
Maybe post it for everybody.
Yeah, open source.
Totally.
Watch the stampede from all your...
Right.
So when you go out to forage, like, what kind of gear do you take with you? Are there any special tools, or maybe like you have a guide for trees to look for? Like, what kind of tools do you use to hunt?
So the gear, it's changed a lot over the years as my concerns for the different finds have changed. I would say the most important thing is proper clothing, lightweight, tough, quick dry materials, waterproof boots and ankle support, a pair of fresh socks, because it always sucks to have soggy feet for more than an hour.
Agreed.
A mosquito net with, you know, mask and hood and stuff, because we spend a lot of time walking around in bogs and swamps, and there are just mosquitoes, like, you know, bugs, period, just fighting to get in your eye. I'll always have a backpack with me, and in that backpack, I always have fire, a knife, water or a water filter, hand lens for examining finds, reagents for identification. In case anybody doesn't know about that, there's a couple of different simple chemicals that you can drop on the mushrooms that help you identify what they are. We carry sets of three of those on the website if you're interested. Specimen tubes for taking, you know, things like cordyceps or a piece of tissue from an interesting find so I can get it back home conserved. We'll keep little desiccant beads in those small envelopes for writing details of finds on, a pen, fabric shopping bags for when you have to be stealth, and a compartmentalized flat tackle box that I can keep in my backpack to keep all the finds separate and to keep the interesting stuff whole and undamaged when I get home. And I like to carry Technu with me because I tend to get poison ivy almost every time I go outside. And lots of snacks because I eat a lot.
Wow.
Baskets, boxes, cooler, camera, camp gear, and a dehydrator if I'm going to be gone for a week.
Wow. You have really dove into every single consideration.
Totally.
With mushroom foraging. Like, I think this is a foolproof sack of
totally
gear.
It's like Ghostbusters for mushrooms. That's awesome.
I'm impressed.
So do you have a favorite? I know this is probably an extremely hard question, and maybe it's pretty easy. Do you have a favorite mushroom to forage?
I think it kind of changes throughout the year, really. Like, I love being in the middle of whatever season's going on. but cordyceps is super exciting to hunt for me.
Hell yeah. I mean, it's just like alchemy, you know, it's like that undiscovered, that rare, you know, knowledge or something. Yeah. It makes it super
unique. I mean, mushroom hunting is like a treasure hunt, and like finding something that obscure is like, it's like finding a rare artifact. So yeah.
Yeah. Indiana Jones style.
Totally.
So do you have any tips for people who are beginning to forage or haven't done it much and want to get better?
There's probably a million things I could say to that, but above all else, I'd probably say sit back for a few years and just watch what's going on and learn before trying to jump in and making a living on nature. There's a lot of nuances invisible to the eyes and mind of a newcomer, and you won't see that stuff until you've really been watching a few years, whether you do it for a living or not. Don't do this for money, because you'll be very let down. It's not a very glamorous way of life. You'll find yourself dirty a lot, wet a lot, covered in bug bites a lot, and coming out empty-handed a lot. So just love what you do. You know, if you love it, then get into it and do it harder than everybody else, no matter what. But don't do it for the money.
That's great advice. Yeah. Thank you for that wisdom. Yeah. You know, there's a lot of really cool, innovative technologies that are coming out. I think it's called iNaturalist, which is an app. I could be wrong. It could be called something else, but you know, an app to help you identify mushrooms. There's also, you know, a mushroom company based in New Hampshire, and the main guy was an engineer, and he made this kind of computer program where he can plug in all this algorithm to basically measure elevation, the type of trees, the slope, the weather, all these different data points, and basically was like, I'm going to find black trumpets and plug it in and plug a whole radius, and we'll get GPS points of what would be the best spots to maybe look for black trumpets. And he would find them, you know, every time. So it seems like we're in an age of, you know, advancing traditional foraging. What do you think is the future of commercial mushroom foraging?
Totally. And on one hand, that is a very exciting advancement. You know, on the other hand, it really resembles the jump from the atlatl to the rifle. You know, it could lead to a huge snafu where there's a lot of people out there in the populated areas just taking everything that's available. I also think that the more people that get into this and start like making money on it and showing that they can make money on it will cause the state and the feds to get more involved. And, you know, anytime they get heavily involved with something, they're like regulating it and taxing it, and they don't even really fully understand how all this stuff works. Like, it's going to take a lot of time to understand all the nuances and whatnot involved with this trade. And I really don't see like officials taking all of that time necessary to fully understand the thing setting the rules and taxations for. So I don't know, you know, I hope it goes really well. I hope those advancements help the people that are, and I hope that people are just more considerate as they get into it.
Awesome. I hear a dog in the background. Do you take your dog out foraging with you?
Oh, totally. Totally, yeah.
My buddy loves it.
She used to be, even just two years ago, she was a lot more spastic and would run off a lot more. But now she's like, she's chilling out. You know, even when she sees a deer or another animal, we can verbally get her to stay near us when we're out picking, so we don't have to stand on the leash the whole time.
That's nice.
Yeah.
Does she help you forage at all, or is she more of a distraction?
No, she's not there yet. She's more of a distraction.
No, truffle dog yet?
I'm going hard. I'm normally in the woods at first light, and I'm picking until last light, and it's normally when I'm by myself. If I'm going out for like a half day or, you know, 6 hour trip or whatever, then Mandy and the dog can come. But, you know, she doesn't like to leave the dog at home, and I don't like to slow down if there's a lot of stuff to do out there. So it's kind of a blend and balance of that.
That sounds fair.
Yeah.
So what's the coolest mushroom or fungi that you've found so far?
And there have been so many thousands, but looking back on all of them, one of them stands out pretty heavily for me right away, and that was the Entoloma parasiticum. That was a parasitic entoloma that is non-stipitate. It's kind of conchiate and shelf-like with radially terminating gills. And I found it on the hymenium of a smooth chanterelle, Cantharellus latericius.
Do you have a visual of this?
I do have a visual of it, yeah. I think it's on my Instagram. If it's not, I will put it on my Instagram. But if you look up Entoloma parasiticum on Google, it's my image that comes up because I'm the only one that's posted an observation with a picture that good, I think.
Awesome. Chanterelle. That's so interesting.
Walt Sturgeon has used that picture before in some of his presentations for NAMA.
Wow.
I think I've seen the picture. And if you want to send us that, we can put it in the show notes.
Totally.
So our viewers can our listeners can view it.
Totally, yeah.
So, you know, you've been talking about cordyceps, how it's really fun to go foraging for, and you know, you clone it in your lab, and you know, how did you get into cordyceps and specifically Cordyceps militaris?
Well, I studied ecology and field biology in school, and I was kind of obsessed with the most bizarre nature shows or lessons or phenomenon that I could find, really. I remember, I think it was Nat Geo, National Geographic, or one of the nature channels doing a special on cordyceps when I was little, and I was just utterly captivated, like glued to the television point blank to hear any details I could about these like magnificently odd parasites. So the fascination for them always stuck, and it didn't really get further fed because nobody really knew that much about them unless they were like going deep into the rainforest to seek them out. But 2 or 3 years into mushroom hunting, I would say it was like 2013, I started finding wild specimens.
So
that was right around the same year I got all the parts to my flow hood and got it put together as well. So cloning them the year after that was pretty much natural progression.
It's funny that you brought up the cordyceps video or episode on, I think it's National Geographic or it's BBC that did a special on it. Or Planet Earth.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, yeah, I actually just showed one of our new employees that video like 30 minutes before this call. And if anyone has not seen that video, please go on YouTube, type in Planet Earth BBC cordyceps, and it will blow your mind, literally.
I don't think that one was out when I was younger, but they did have some footage of some ones on like caterpillars and ants and stuff like that.
Oh, and a more OG video.
Yeah, yeah, totally.
I got to see this one. That's awesome.
I mean, this was in the 80s, probably late 80s, early 90s. Nice.
They were with it. They knew
what's
up.
Good job, 80s, early 90s. So when you are getting new genetics for cordyceps, what genes are you looking for exactly?
Well, the ones that we can find are always a plus. Sometimes they don't like to reveal themselves at all. You got to crawl around in the swamp for days and not find anything. But when we do get stuff, if it prints for us and I go from spore, then I'm looking for the fast growth, dense growth, and the highly pigmented growth. If I'm looking at the traits on the wild specimens themselves, it's like any odd or desirable trait, like multiple stroma or a new host or odd temperatures that I found it in or stuff like that. You know, anything with good bioefficiency. If it's got a bunch of stroma hanging off of it, then you know it's going to be good at turning rice into weight.
Yeah, that's good advice. So you provided a lot of us cultivators with Cordyzilla, which was a strain that ripped. And oh my gosh, we probably inoculated like 13,000 jars with Cordyzilla.
That makes me sick.
And that's not including the bins or the other random experiments.
And 003 before that. So that was the original one before Cordyzilla. And
yeah,
you've been an awesome supplier for the Western world for Cordyceps genetics.
Yeah. Thanks, guys.
The Cordyzilla in our veins. So I'm curious about Cordyzilla's story, like where you found this mushroom and how you knew that it was going to be a star.
So Cordyzilla was actually found by Mandy. She was much better on the eyes that day. She found several specimens that I just walked right past. But I knew it was going to be special because it had more stroma coming off of it than any one specimen I had ever found. It had 10 stroma heads on it. So anything that was like that prolific at making that much ascocarp weight was just really of interest to me. And it was found in Virginia, not too far outside of Culpeper.
Nice. Thanks, Mandy.
Yeah, we got to go back. That sounds like a good place. And what are your thoughts on especially doing this isolation work on the difference between multispore versus colony isolation as a form of inoculant?
Yeah, so the multispore is always going to display a wider array of phenotypical and chemotypical forms. You know, it's for selecting behavior traits that you want, really. And the other way, you can really hone in on exactly what it is you want or hone in on just more bioefficiency.
So when would you want to use a multispore?
So like I said, I like to use the multispore when I want to give the cultivator a broader selection of characteristics in the fruit bodies that they're growing for future strain development. If I sold a multispore culture, I would tell them it was a multispore so that they could make that decision themselves, because you don't really want to run a multispore out on bulk because it's going to do a bunch of different things. It's not going to... How should I say this? It's not going to
be consistent.
Yeah. Behave consistently in one direction.
Right. So
the monoculture is meant for max performance in a desired direction.
Yeah. And this is really important because Cordyceps senesce really quickly and they pitter out. So, you know, getting those different genetic varieties is really important for us growers of figuring out, you know, selecting the genetics that we really want. And, you know, you've been in the Cordyceps industry, especially the Cordyceps militaris industry for a while now, and kind of changing the game in the Western world in terms of supplying cultivators everywhere in the Western world with prime genetics. And what do you think is the future of the Cordyceps militaris industry?
Yeah, so a couple of things come to mind right away, and the senescence being one of them. Most strains can only tolerate anywhere from 2 to 8 sectors before they lose their compatible mating type and they won't fruit anymore. Or if they do fruit, they only make sterile fruit bodies, and you can't really get spores off of those to make new generations. So I think genetic manipulation for many different purposes, you know, for physical traits as far as like colors and weight and stuff like that first, but later on for chemotypes as people stop their obsession with just the cordycepin alone, they're going to realize there's other dozens and dozens of beneficial compounds in this mushroom that they can be extracting. And all the chemotypes that arise from all this breeding are going to favor different profiles of these compounds in there. You know, which strain makes the most of this terpene or that enzyme complex. Designing tougher strains compatible of good fruiting at 80 or 90 degrees is another interest, because there's a lot of people in third world countries that don't have air conditioning. And even if they do, they can't really afford to run it all the time. So finding the heat strains is definitely part of the future of it. And biological engineering of tools useful in things like forest management for different, insect pests, as well as agriculture and stuff like that.
So impressive. Yeah, I look forward to the development.
And I wholeheartedly agree with all points that you just said. Yeah. And we just did an interview with Ryan Paul Gates about genetics, and you both are on the same, you know, level and are leading this industry in a very cool way, because there's not many people working with fungal genetics. And we're talking about extraction methods in the cannabis industry. Genetics are huge, and just looking at how they work with genetics, and also some of the downfalls of sharing genetics and people patenting genetics and all these things.
Totally.
It's important to follow in their footsteps and do it in a good way. With the THC craze, and it's like, well, it's not just cordycepin. There's tons of molecules in there. And of course we're going to have a star child molecule or compound, that people are going to kind of follow and love, but it goes way more full spectrum, which I really admire what you're doing with Spagyrics. Of, you know, it's way even more beyond the physical realm. You know, you're getting into the spiritual, the whole celestial realms that, most people are not there yet. But I think you're far beyond what most people are at, and that's really cool. And thanks for the work that you're doing, and it's awesome to have you on the show.
Thanks kindly.
So you run Mushroom Life with Mandy, who is your life partner, and we wanted to know how it is working with each other in your business and how you complement each other.
Yeah, so it's unfolding very interestingly. You learn a lot about yourself through others, especially living and working with them. Mushroom Life was around for years before the partnership, but things looked very different without all the stuff that she brings to the table. You know, we're capable of doing a lot more working together, for sure. I'd say that I hold a lot of, like, the fire and motive for the business, and she helps with, like, direction and organization.
That's a really good balance. Mm-hmm. That's awesome. And totally. Yeah, we have the final, it's so sad, the final question. And this is the question we ask all our people that we have on the show. And this is also open for anyone listening to this podcast. Please, we would love to hear your answer as well. So please shoot us an email or give us a call or shoot us a text or a message with your response. So the question is, if mushrooms could have the mic and could give a sentence or two to the whole human race, what would they say?
Wow. Well, it kind of seems like we are handing them the mic lately with all of the attention we're giving them and observation we're giving them. And what they all seem to be teaching or saying is get over yourself and transmute, unbiasedly make the base ingredients of life into your gold. Take the everyday ingredients and transmute that into the useful.
Amen.
Awesome. Yeah. And everyone, again, please check out Michael Weiss online, all of his social media, his website, as always, much love, and may the spores be with you.